Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. My guest today is a descendant of an old North Carolina family who traces her roots back through a prominent Southern plantation owner to an officer in the American Revolution. In fact, she's a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, or the DAR, and beyond that, back to one of the noblemen who accompanied William the Conqueror from France on his little foray into England in 1066, or whenever it was. She has a doctorate in education leadership and is on the faculty at Appalachian State University. Her name is Leslie Dula McKesson. She was born a Dula, D-U-L-A, a clan in western North Carolina that has different variant spellings and has included people like one Tom Dooley. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Remember that one? So he was kind of a black sheep of the family. And Leslie herself is a black woman. I'll bet you didn't see that coming. She wrote a book about her family history called Black and White, the story of Harriet Harshaw and Squire James Alfred Dula. It's a love story set before and after the Civil War, the kind of love story that took great courage because it could easily get you killed at that time, no matter how prominent you were. She's here to share that story with us. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you, Court. Glad to be here.
Great to have you on. You've done a ton of genealogical research into your family, the Dulas, over a period of many years and going back centuries. Without going into too much detail, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of their history prior to Squire Alfred's time in the Civil War era?
Sure. The first Dulas to come to America was a man named Robert Dowling, actually, D-O-W-L-I-N-G. The name has gone through several changes throughout the centuries. But he came in about 1720 to Virginia, and with him he brought a son named Thomas. And Thomas is the grandfather of William, who is the Revolutionary War patriot. So the Dulas landed in America a little before the big rush of Irish folks during the potato famine. They'd been here for a while when the other folks got here. It goes back to about 1720, and there's quite a good bit of documentation about it in the records, public records in Virginia.
So I mentioned in the beginning the love affair between Squire Alfred, who'd acquired through his family a lot of land in western North Carolina, and one of his slaves, a young woman named Harriet Harshaw. Why don't you tell us about them and how they got together and what happened to them?
This is, to me, an amazing story. It's a very personal story, and I hesitate in many ways now to call it a love story just because of the context in which it took place. You know, we have our own contemporary sense of what love is and how it plays out and how it feels, and I'm just not as comfortable as I may have been at one time in assigning that title or that emotion to the relationship because of the fact that there was not a parity, you know, between them, because of the fact that Harriet did not have ultimate and complete choice. I think it was a relationship that involved dedication, most definitely, on his part and on her part. I think there was some sense of connection and fidelity between them. I really hesitate to go so far as to call it love anymore. But the bottom line of the story is that Alfred was married to a young woman named Elizabeth Evelyn Corpening. She was, of course, a white woman because at the time, the laws of the South, the anti-miscegenation laws, would not allow people of different races to marry. That, in fact, didn't even change until 1967. So Harriet and Alfred could never have been married, though a lot of people call her his second wife. That wasn't a legal reality. Alfred married Elizabeth Evelyn Corpening, and they had six children together prior to her early and untimely death in 1846. She was in her early 30s and died shortly after giving birth to their youngest son. Alfred, shortly thereafter, or perhaps even a little bit before that, we're not sure the timing, purchased an enslaved woman named Harriet Harshaw to take charge of his household, basically, to run his home, to help take care of his children, to, you know, see to their care and provision. And she came to his household in 1846, and with her, she brought two small children. These small children had been born to her apparently by another white man. We don't know for sure who he was. You know, I've got some theories about that, but as yet no DNA or anything like that to prove it, just some thoughts and ideas. but she brought with her a 3-year-old son and a baby who was just a matter of months old. The son was Solomon and the daughter was Amanda. Alfred and Harriet apparently did not have any kind of a relationship with one another for probably the first 5 years or so that she was there, because it was in the 6th year after Harriet came to the Dula household that their first son together, Samuel, was born. Altogether, over the course of time, Harriet and Alfred had 8 children. During the remainder of their lives together, Alfred never remarried, though he certainly could have. You know, a wealthy, well-known man from his community, I'm sure he could have married again. So there may be, you know, some reason to assume some level of affection on his part. I don't know. You know, it's still all a big assumption. But he never remarried. That was the bottom line. And he chose to take care of or provide for his children with Harriet. During their lifetimes, he taught the children to read, taught Harriet to read, taught them to write, and at his death, he left a large amount of property, land, to his black sons with Harriet, and that's where a community called Dula Town began.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying about it not being valid to call it love.
Yes.
There are other examples of long-lasting relationships between slave owner and slave, like the story of Squire Alfred and Harriet. The most obvious one I know of is Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, he kept her in what amounts to a cellar. It was not in the open. Most mixings of white and black genes between master and slave didn't come from love or even just consensual affairs. It was basically rape, even if not necessarily violent. It was sex between someone with total power and someone with no power at all.
Exactly.
They had no choice.
Absolutely, yeah.
What's so remarkable about your family's story is that Alfred didn't try to hide his relationship with Harriet.
Yes.
And they paid for that openness.
Yes.
Once the relationship between Alfred and Harriet became known, Leslie, what happened in their surrounding community where this was like total anathema?
There were a couple of stories that accompanied this relationship. I think the one that I think of first is when some people in the community arranged to basically kidnap Harriet and have her carried off. It's always been just a matter of oral history, and the story has been told in varying ways, but the bottom line appears to be that the people who orchestrated this kidnapping were actually members of Alfred's family, had her taken off, and were more or less trying to distance the two of them, to impede what they may have sensed as an inappropriate relationship. And and Alfred found out somehow where she was, went and got her and brought her back, and made it clear that this was not to ever happen again. So she was never taken away again. But that was one example of just the reaction of the community during that time, and particularly his family.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense that it would have been family, because if it were not, she'd have probably been killed, and maybe even him.
Yes, yeah.
And he would not have been able to instruct them never to do it again, because they wouldn't have cared if it wasn't his family.
Yes, they wouldn't have listened. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, you mentioned all the children that Alfred had, 6 before they got together, and Harriet had 2 before they got together. That's 8. And they had 6 more together?
Yeah.
That's 14, so looking through your book, there are so many children.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at the pages where you describe each ancestor, the average number of children in a family seems to have been at least 10, sometimes as many as 14.
Yeah.
And the infant mortality rate didn't seem to have been as high as my impression is that it was all around the rest of the country.
Yes.
Because from what I could tell, the great majority of these children lived. Good genes, I guess. So there was a huge number of children being born.
Absolutely.
It seems like the doulas kind of populated half of Western North Carolina.
You better believe it. Yeah, and yes, and that's why there's so many now. You mentioned, I think Harriet and Alfred actually had 8 together, in addition to the two that she brought with her. Yeah. I tell you, the numbers, I get confounded every now and then. I have to pull out my papers and go back into it and take my fingers and toes and count. But Harriet had at least 106 grandchildren. This is from Solomon and Amanda, who were the two that she brought with her, and the eight children that she and Alfred had together. So, you know, just imagine having 106 grandchildren. That's insane.
She could only remember the names of like eight of them.
Exactly, exactly. And the funny thing is that there were so many that a lot of them had the same names. Because, you know, back in those days, everybody named everybody after some ancestor. So it was super confusing. And this was my grandfather's generation. My grandfather was Harriet's grandson. So 106 of them, two generations behind me, and now I'm a grandmother. So you can imagine how many, it's just unimaginable how many descendants there are of this line of doulas.
Needless to say, your generation is not having nearly so many kids.
No, thank goodness. I had four, so, you know, I kind of did a little more than average, but 10 kids is kind of unsustainable these days since we don't live on farms and grow our own food anymore.
Hard to imagine. Back then, you needed all those kids to help run the farm.
Yeah, just to help take care of the household, yeah.
Now they're just a lot of college tuitions to pay for.
There you go.
Well, tell us about Doulatown, North Carolina, Leslie. That's the center of the doula universe, I gather.
Yeah, yeah. Doulatown, as I mentioned, started as a devise in Alfred's will. In his will, he died in 1882, I believe. And he left nearly 2,000 acres, all told, to his black children with Harriet. Now, all of that wasn't in the will. He had started to give pieces of real property to his sons during his lifetime. To his black sons, he gave homes to his white sons, so he took care of all of his children, but he gave most of the land to his black children. Again, starting before he died, there are actually records of these property transfers that are still in existence at the Caldwell County Register of Deeds, and I've gone over there and just kind of spent time in their presence, and it's weird how connected you can feel to a document, you know, just knowing that it at one time touched your ancestors. So there's a very comprehensive record of property transfers there in the Caldwell County Register of Deeds office. He also transferred property to Harriet, but he did it more as a life estate rather than as a fee simple transfer, because I guess part of it was because she was a woman, you know, because he gave absolute ownership to the sons. I'm not aware of any property transfers that he gave to his two black daughters with Harriet, Emma and Caroline. Although I've heard some of my relatives from those lines say that there was something that they inherited. That's just not something that I'm familiar with. But all told, it's been estimated that as much as 2,000 acres of land was left to his black descendants. In his will, he left a condition, and he required of his executor, who was his oldest white son, to see to it that the property interests of Harriet Doula's children were preserved, even to the extent of the full cost of his estate. So he did what he could do to see to the preservation of that land. I think probably understanding that would be the that would be the difference between survival and extinction for his black family.
Yeah, I'm assuming it was very unusual for large tracts of land to be owned like that, especially contiguous property encompassing a big chunk of land on the landscape, to be owned by the descendants of slaves back then.
Yes.
You know, I'm sure there were freedmen who got 40 acres and a mule or something.
Mm-hmm.
But for the good part of a county to be owned by the descendants of slaves, especially in this case so uniquely that they were all related, must have been highly unusual.
Yes. I think it was pretty rare. I've heard of a family in the Burke County area, which is where I live now, that has a similar story, but I haven't heard about it in the detail that I know of the Doolittown story, and I don't know the amount of land that was transferred, but I think there was a somewhat similar story involved.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Leslie Dula McKesson about her family and her roots in western North Carolina in the town called Doolittown, which was founded by the descendants of a couple who had a decades-long relationship. He was a white plantation owner, and she was his slave, and they had 8 children together. And we're talking about how he left in his will, and even before his death, left a large amount of land to all his descendants equally, his white children and his mixed-race children with Harriet, his slave. And I guess we could almost call her his common-law wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, I watch Finding Your Roots with Dr. Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and you might too, I don't know, but it's always a fascinating show.
Mm-hmm.
So many times when his guest is black, they run into a dead end in tracing their history, because we were talking about how far back you know Squire James Alfred Dula's ancestry going back centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of American slaves, their history usually stops with slavery, because that's where that divide occurred in the passage across from Africa to here, and suddenly the past was erased for them.
Yes.
So it's just first names. You know, they were treated as possessions, which they were at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They had no legal standing until the Reconstruction period, and no official recording of them as people with first and last names and a real identity until the 1870 census.
Mm-hmm.
So did that bifurcation, where you could go back forever on one side and only back a couple centuries at most on the other side, did that complicate your research into your family background?
It did. And there is still a brick wall at Harriet's mother. We don't even know her name. DNA recently shed light on who we believe now to be her father. And although it was a shock when you put the pieces together, it makes a lot of sense. It would appear that her father was a slave retailer. Basically, that was his job. You know, he bought, raised, reared, sold, and leased out slaves. And her mother was probably a woman that he owned at some point. But we have no information about her, not even a name, not... The only thing that we know about her is that at some point she lived in Virginia. Whether she was born there or not, no information. So we have not been able to trace anything conclusive past Harriet. And there's that brick wall that slavery creates.
So the thing that makes the bridge now between those two sides is DNA. And that's what you see on that show, Finding Your Roots, and that's what you found too in your research. It's kind of the bridge between the white and black sides of your ancestry.
Yes.
But with DNA, Dr. Gates can find, as you found, the bridge to the white side of their ancestry. And it turns out, to many people's surprise, that they have these connections that they didn't know about, or maybe that were kind of whispered about, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, you say that on average, American black people have 23%, I think it is, of Western European DNA. That's equivalent to having one white grandparent.
Right.
I mean, it might not be that they have one white grandparent, but they have an admixture of different strains coming into their DNA from different sources that add up to the equivalent of having one white grandparent.
Right. And that was a snapshot of time. You know, DNA has progressed a lot since then. A lot more people have been tested, so the figure may be different now. But at the time, and I think it was still fairly early in DNA testing, it was a pretty high percentage of European ancestry for African Americans in the South. And part of that could have been the suspicion that there was European ancestry. You know, it could have been that those were the folks who were more inclined to have DNA testing to determine if the rumors were true, if the old family histories were true. So with the passage of time, the percentages may be somewhat different now, but in the early phases of DNA testing, it was surprising to me that four of the major DNA testing programs or products, I guess, averaged together about 23%, which, as you say, is basically like having one white grandparent. It just shows the extent of racial mixture in the South.
Yeah, and the same thing really applies to whites. Southern whites in particular, on average, I think, are said to have about 25% Native American blood.
Wow.
These are people who are born in the Deep South, right?
Mm-hmm.
We describe America as a melting pot, meaning of immigrants from Europe and other continents, like Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But in the early days of the nation, out on the frontier, we were a melting pot of another kind because it was tough men going out there and trying to hack a living out of the wilderness. And a lot of the time, the only women around were Native American women.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of a similar thing, but in a different way.
Yeah.
Were there other strains of mixture of different races in your family background, Leslie, that you were surprised to find as you dug into it?
Well, Native American was in there, and that wasn't a surprise. That one was just a validation because we had always known that Harriet had Native American ancestry. We have not figured out, you know, where it comes in, how it comes in, because apart from the DNA evidence now that we have pointing us to a father, we don't know anything about her mother's ancestry. So where the Native American piece came in is still a bit of a mystery. But that was just a validation because, you know, a lot of black people in the South claim Native American ancestry as well. I think studies have shown that some African Americans claim Native ancestry instead of European ancestry, just because, you know, there's a perceived nobility there with the Native American ancestry, as opposed to the colonizer, you know, that the European side brings.
Or the rapist.
Or the rapist, absolutely. There's just not that negative energy that goes with being genetically assigned to Native American ancestors that could come with being assigned to European ancestors.
I think there was a long period of time in the South, too, when Native Americans had more legal rights than African Americans did.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could own property and things like that and even marry across races more easily.
Right.
And so I think there may have been just a practical side to wanting to claim that as well as the social and psychological side.
Right, yeah. And there was, you know, just, you don't want to talk about degrees of oppression because that's not really a cool thing to do. But at some point, there was a bit more acceptance of Native Americans into European society than there was blacks. You know, a Native American could be adopted by someone and sent to school at Harvard, still to be oppressed, still to be subjugated, but, you know, kind of taken in like a favored pet. So, you know, I think that, I think enough said about that.
Okay, well, we're kind of getting toward the end of the show, but what tools and sources did you use in your research, Leslie? I know you mentioned DNA. Did you use Ancestry.com and 23andMe? You said there were four different platforms that you used.
Mm-hmm. I used Ancestry.com, 23andMe. I used a source called Family Tree DNA, And the fourth one that I used, and actually the very first one that I used, was called DNA Consultants. That was a very comprehensive and the first one that I used. And that was the one that kind of blew my mind, because I saw, you know, Portuguese and Morocco and, you know, just ancestry from virtually all over the world. And that was an eye-opener to me. But you think back to the origins of slavery, and it's probably not uncommon for African Americans to have some Portuguese ancestry.
Yeah, that's right. They were basically gathered along the west coast of Africa in some Portuguese colonies, and the keepers and middlemen there were Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Yes, yes. And that whole rape scenario started there. So, yeah.
What a terrible thing. Well, listen, switching to a happier subject, how do the white and black and in-between parts of the Dula clan get along today?
Get along beautifully. For the most part, you know, there are still those on either side who just leave me alone. Don't bring me into your little story. I'm not a part of it. But there is a core of black and white doulas that are very connected. We have a reunion every other year, a Harriet reunion, and we've got white family that comes to that. We've got a Doula Town page on Facebook, where we remain connected, share photographs, you know, keep up with, you know, obituaries and things like that. It's a hard thing, but we can stay in touch and informed about the family. We celebrate kids going to college and doing marvelous things, and we support each other with, you know, through hard times and that kind of thing. So there's a very strong virtual community, and there's a very strong physical community too. I've got some extremely close friends right now who are my cousins on the doula side, black and white, and we get together and laugh and eat and just do things that family would do. They may be my fourth cousins, which is far out, you know, but we call each other cousin and we act like family.
Well, that's great. You're really lucky to have such a big family and such a diverse family.
Yes.
And I'll bet your family reunions are probably fun, more than most family reunions are.
I think so.
And you have them, which most families don't have anymore. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to point our listeners to another good thing. There's a documentary film that I think you narrated, Leslie, called Doula Town. It was produced by Appalachian State University, and it aired on UNC TV, which is University of North Carolina TV. People can go online and search Doula Town, D-U-L-A Town, App State, A-P-P State, to find it on Vimeo. It's a half-hour-long documentary. Pretty interesting, and it covers the same ground we've talked about here, but you can put the faces to the names and the voices, right?
Yeah. It also aired on East Tennessee Public TV, so you may find it there as well.
Okay, good. And you can find the book. Again, it's Black and White, The Story of Harriet Harshaw and Squire James Alfred Doula, on Amazon, and the author is Leslie Doula McKesson. Well, Leslie Doula McKesson, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety Radio. It's been really interesting.
It's been a pleasure, Court. Thank you for your interest.
Sure. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.